That does not matter. You can tie up all moral philosophy with a common and private life just as well as with a life of richer stuff. Each man bears the entire form of man's estate. Does he mean it? Or does he think that all men are revealed in one particular man, Michel de Montaigne? This is not humility, nor do we want humility. Montaigne brings the ego into literature. At least I have one thing according to the rules, that no man ever treated a subject he knew and understood better than I do the subject I have undertaken. And that in this, I am the most learned man alive. Before Whitman, Montaigne made a long and glorious catalogue of himself. Although I was trained as much as possible for freedom and adaptability, yet it is a fact that through carelessness, and because I have lingered more in certain ways as I grow old, my age is past training and henceforth has nothing to consider except holding its own. Habit, imperceptibly, has already so imprinted its character upon me in certain things that I call it excess to depart from it. And I cannot, without an effort, sleep by day, or eat between meals, or breakfast, or go to bed without a long interval of about 3 full hours after supper, or make a child except before going to sleep, or make one standing up, or endure my sweat, or quench my thirst with pure water or pure wine, or remain bareheaded for long, or have my hair cut after dinner. And I would feel as uncomfortable without my gloves as without my shirt, or without washing when I leave the table or get up in the morning, or without a canopy and curtains for my bed, as I would be without really necessary things. I could dine without a tablecloth, but very uncomfortably without a clean napkin, German fashion. I soil napkins more than they or the Italians do, and make little use of spoon or fork. Nothing life-threatening here, though the tone seemed miraculously perfect. Montaigne, one feels, was a good man, not something I would dream of saying about most of the other authors in Columbia's canon. From the listing of his habits, there arises not fear and caution, and certainly not shame, but the most noble resolve. Taylor told us that Montaigne, who suffered badly from gallstones, had passed from an early stoicism to a more and more confident and joyous Epicureanism. That is, his early preoccupation with pain and how to die well, a great theme of the Roman writers he admired, gave way in middle age to a greater and greater acceptance of life, especially the pleasures of life. But the Stoic note never quite disappears, even in Of Experience, his final essay before dying at age 59. What shall we say of the fact that even doubt and inquiry strikes our imagination and changes us? Those who yield suddenly to these propensities bring total ruin upon themselves. And I am sorry for several gentlemen who, by the stupidity of their doctors, have made prisoners of themselves, though still young and sound in health. It would still be better to endure a cold than to lose the enjoyment of social life forever through disuse by giving up so general a practice. It is a troublesome science which decries the pleasantest hours of the day. Let us extend our possession to our utmost means. Most often we toughen ourselves if we persist and correct our constitutions, as Caesar did his epilepsy, by despising it and fighting it. We should conform to the best rules, but not enslave ourselves to them, unless to those, if any there are, to which bondage and slavery is useful. Both kings and philosophers defecate, and ladies too. This was extraordinary, but I was sure when reading it that my life was not at stake. One look at Montaigne made standard left academic complaints about hegemony seem absurd. It was a literal hegemony, The tyranny of scholastic philosophy that Montaigne disliked. In Montaigne's time, dogmatism was beginning to wane, but he went one step further than skepticism. One of the great late Renaissance humanists, Montaigne renounced intellectual and spiritual authority, and that renunciation became his authority. He was interested not in scholastic proofs of this or that, but in mental activity, the movement of thought, and he put such movement right into the essays themselves. And then Taylor read the opening to Montaigne's Of Repentance. Others form man. I tell of him, and portray a particular one, very ill-formed, whom I should really make very different from what he is if I had to fashion him over again. But now it is done. Now the lines of my painting do not go astray, though they change and vary. The world is but a perennial movement. All things in it are in constant motion. The earth, the rocks of the Caucasus, the pyramids of Egypt, both with the common motion and with their own. Stability itself is nothing but a more languid motion. I cannot keep my subject still. It goes along befuddled and staggering with a natural drunkenness. I take it in this condition, just as it is at the moment I give my attention to it. I do not portray being, I portray passing. Not the passing from one age to another, or, as the people say, from 7 years to 7 years, but from day to day, from minute to minute. My history needs to be adapted to the moment. I may presently change, not only by chance, but also by intention. This is a record of variable and changeable occurrences, and of irresolute and, when it so befalls, contradictory ideas. Whether I am different myself or whether I take hold of my subjects in different circumstances and aspects. So all in all, I may indeed contradict myself now and then, but truth is, Damavis said, I do not contradict. If my mind could gain a firm footing, I would not make essays, I would make decisions. But it is always in apprenticeship and on trial. This description moves in time, said Taylor. It's not a definition, it's a process. Montaigne offers a sense of a self for the first time in history that isn't based on being. Look, all the philosophers up to Montaigne, they were all concerned with being. God is the big being. But Montaigne wants to describe being in motion. I don't depict being, he's saying. I depict becoming. I now saw what Taylor was getting at with his portentous opening sally. Montaigne hated rote learning. He complained of his poor memory, but believed in his judgment. Learning to read and to judge was what Lit Hum was about for Taylor. In Lit Hum, the student would struggle with some of the great achievements in literature, and each book would stretch a student in a different direction. The course was not a specific body of knowledge injected into students like truth serum, nor was it a way of donning the armature of Western values. It was a struggle with difficult and faraway texts, which forced willy-nilly the trying on of selves, and it ended in the uniqueness of the individual student that emerged from the many selves. That's why the students' lives were at stake when they read Montaigne. For Montaigne was the supreme example of the kind of becoming that Professor Edward Taylor believed in. My mother died the way she did everything, decisively and in great haste. When we began reading King Lear in Lit Hum's spring semester, she'd been dead a little over a year. I had, it turned out, a peculiar, unsought intimacy with this play. When my mother was ill and at her worst about 4 years before she died, I thought about King Lear more than anyone would want to. She is King Lear, I would say angrily to my wife, after an impossible phone call or visit, the joke seeming staler and less illuminating each time. She was also my mother, Ida Denby, unhappy as hell and eager to let me know it. A flesh-and-blood worry, mine as well as her own. The intimacy with Lear was not just my own. For once, the echoes knocking about in the media and our heads were not far from the truth. Everyone knows this overwhelming work, at least by reputation, as a fable of stubborn, unreasonable old age and vindictive and ungrateful youth. What people cannot know if they haven't recently read Lear is the play's wrenching combination of tenderness and malevolence. Gearing up to read it again, I felt something like fear. It was immense, looming, threatening. Sinister and violent, as well as noble. A great work that comes and finds us out. Certainly, if it doesn't suggest something intimate to us, it risks seeming outrageous and improbable. A preposterous fable with overwrought emotions and extravagantly embittered poetry. Much of it, details of the story and individual lines, came back readily enough, and with the force of accusation. I was unsettled right at the beginning by the irascible force of the opening scene, the hardness and bitterness, the sense of catastrophe unfolding as a kind of joke. Lear, a tough old bastard, intelligent but without insight, gives up the power of the kingship but refuses to give up the precedence and trappings of his royal position. We don't know why he does this. Apart from the folly of unkinging himself, he is not in any sense failing. He describes himself later as every inch a king, and he is. His abdication is a mystery compounded by vanity and wrath. But that doesn't quite capture the strangeness of it. Look again. The play is set in motion by an excessive parental demand for love. The demand for love. Could anything be more homely and banal? Before the first scene, Lear has decided to award the largest portion of his kingdom to Cordelia, his youngest daughter and his favorite. But then, seeking confirmation and promising to reward in kind, Lear asks each of his three daughters how much she loves him. It is a kind of trial, an embarrassing command performance of affection. Disgusted, Cordelia proudly refuses to match the effusive protestations of her sisters by saying, "I cannot heave my heart into my mouth." And Lear, in a rage, immediately dispossesses her. "So young and so untender?" "So young, my lord, and true."
"Let it be so. Thy truth then be thy dower. For by the sacred radiance of the sun, the mysteries of Hecate and the night, by all the operation of the orbs from whom we do exist and cease to be, here I disclaim all my paternal care, propinquity and property of blood, and as a stranger to my heart and me, hold thee from this forever. The barbarous Scythian, or he that makes his generation messes to gorge his appetite, shall to my bosom be as well neighbored, pitied, and relieved as thou, my sometime daughter."
The play begins with folly and disaster and goes downhill from there. The two flattering daughters, Goneril and Regan, divide the kingdom and almost immediately betray their father, successively stripping him of honor, privilege, comfort, and shelter. Little can be said in extenuation of the way Goneril and Regan behave. They want their father dead, but their depredations and Cordelia's prideful silence can both be seen as a revolt against the humiliating demand for love. It is an emotion most of us would find too embarrassing to talk about. But Shakespeare was nothing if not apocalyptic at this stage of his career. Macbeth came next. And once the bonds of family love are broken, everything goes. Everything. The frame of the state, the physical universe itself cracks and splits, and the elements whirl into contention. Civilization gives way to barbarism, shelter to brutal exposure, fellow feeling to feral and carnivorous appetite. The imagery turns ferocious. The subordinate animal kingdom of wolves, snakes, rats, everything that bites and eats, turns on men with fury. Lear himself casts off his old manner, his sanity, his clothes. It is a process violent beyond belief of unraveling, unhousing, and undressing, until the king is out in a storm with his few remaining loyal subjects, and for the first time in his life, senses what poor and miserable people must suffer. Poor naked wretches, wheresoe'er you are, that bide the pelting of this pitiless storm. How shall your houseless heads and unfed sides, your looped and windowed raggedness, defend you from seasons such as these? Oh, I have ta'en too little care of this. Take physic, pomp, expose thyself to feel what wretches feel, that thou mayst shake the superflux to them and show the heavens more just. Man without a house, without clothes, without civilization, laws, forms of respect, is nothing. And Lear, now remorseful and anguished, needs to feel the nothingness in his own skin. Thou wert better in the grave than to answer with thy uncovered body this extremity of the skies. Is man no more than this? Consider him well. Thou owest the worm no silk, the beast no hide, the sheep no wool, the cat no perfume. Ha! Here's three ons are sophisticated. Thou art the thing itself. Unaccommodated man is no more but such a poor, bare, forked animal as thou art. Off! Off, you lendings! Come, unbutton here. Lear confronts his errors, harrows himself, attains a new consciousness of himself. The forces of good rally and join, and Lear is reconciled with Cordelia and with his old friend Gloucester, who, misjudging his own family, has undergone a similar lacerating ordeal of betrayal and renewal. Redemption of a sort is possible, almost achieved. But evil has grown perverse and extensive, and help arrives too late. The bodies pile up, including Lear's and Cordelia's. From its beginnings in banality and dismay, Lear goes right to the edge of annihilation, a myth of suffering and knowledge to rival Oedipus the King, with a richness of bleak imagery and almost manic high foolishness that is no less amazing on third or fourth reading. If there's great suffering in the play, there's also a magnificent gaiety in it. Altogether, it gave more pleasure and pain than any other work in either of Columbia's courses. A few years earlier, when I worried about my mother, I thought constantly of the play. Now, reading Lear again, I thought constantly of her. The play is about fierce, pre-Christian aristocrats, not American Jewish mothers. But Ida Denby was the Lear of my life. When Lear loses everything and fears he will go insane, his loving fool, who continues to attend him, speaks to him in penetrable riddles, a seeming madness to mirror Lear's madness, a manic yet utterly faithful critique of Lear's action and state. And similarly, Edgar, Gloucester's good son, speaks to his deluded father and to Lear in the character of poor Tom, a noisy addlepate who thinks that the universe has conspired against him. Shakespeare's poetry of pretend madness is made almost unbearably moving by the deeply loving intention behind it. The fool and Edgar hope to nurse the two tormented old men back to mental health with their provocations, while hateful Goneril and Regan speak to Lear in the tones of the coldest rationality, trying to check his anguished demands with reason. How many nights shall Lear retain when he stays with either of them? I'll go with thee. Thy 50 yet doth double 25, and thou art twice her love. Hear me, my lord. What need you 25, 10, or 5, to follow in a house where twice so many have a command to tend you? What need one? No reason not the need. Our basest beggars are in the poorest things superfluous. Allow not nature more than nature needs. Man's life is as cheap as beasts. Thou art a lady. If only to go warm were gorgeous. Why, nature needs not what thou gorgeous wearst, which scarcely keeps thee warm. The famous lines mortified me as I read the play again, because I was forever trying to reason with my mother, trying to separate her real difficulties from her imagining of difficulty. My mother did not know that she possessed an unconscious. She had the noble, infuriating density of fully achieved ego, a pre-Freudian personality. That was partly the source of her strength and of her capacity for happiness. Throughout our lives together, I struggled to get her to see herself, but she would not be my student. Was I really helping her with my logical, patient questions? If only I could have let fly my fancy, any fancy that worked, and performed a cure out of love, a cure like the Fool's or Edgar's. Reading King Lear again, I see a bit of Goneril and Regan's stony rigor breaking through my exasperated relation to my mother. I revenged myself on her long-held strength by refusing to engage her madness. How could I not have realized that emotionally she needed reassurance, not reality? At Columbia in early spring, the number of football and frisbee tossers doubled and redoubled, and a great many other undergraduates, like creatures newly emerged from the sea, sat on the broad steps of Low Library with their pale faces in the sun, which hung rather low in the sky above Butler Library to the south. Climbing up the stairs to get to Mathematics Hall for CC class, I walked around women in black jeans, T-shirts, and leather jackets, and men in army drab, some with long hair or a touch of beard under the chin. Undergraduates as a tribe were both sullen and polite. Proudly reserved, they would nevertheless become quite eager if anyone showed serious interest in them. Take one out to lunch and he would tell you everything. A vaguely parental emotion stirred within me. Let them eat. Let them get some sleep. Some color. It was a happy week. Reading Nietzsche, I was wildly exhilarated. More than once I came close to laughing out loud at how good a time I was having, how lawless and strong I felt. For the moment at least, I was freed from the burden of respect and of caring. For the American liberal, and some conservatives too, everyone must be esteemed, everyone's complaints and troubles taken seriously, every cause, every group, every problem and failure respected, understood, sympathized with, given a break. It's an exhausting and exhaustive task, producing an inevitable disgust. In the 90s, liberal faith, or at least faith in governmental solutions to the problems of poverty, crime, inequality, was crumbling rapidly, and one sign of the collapse was a little voice that muttered insistently in one's brain, "Not everyone deserves sympathy. Some people are screwing themselves up." Say that aloud, however, and you will get killed in some quarters. Nietzsche kicked hell out of liberal dutifulness. The assigned CC text on the genealogy of morals from 1887, one of Nietzsche's last books before he fell into insanity, is a hilarious, rancorous attack on egalitarianism and democracy, on modern bourgeois civilization, on Judaism, Christianity, on everything that most Westerners would call humane and necessary. A tremendous explosion of scorn and despair. The book is unnervingly intelligent and authentically scandalous. For anyone tired of the routine shocks of movies or MTV, or the farcical outrages of the New York avant-garde in recent years, this was the real thing, an untamable and unregenerate book. How had the universities assimilated this most dangerous man? Well, there was no doubt Nietzsche had become a powerful influence on the academic left. In his first class on Nietzsche, Stephenson quoted Princeton, now Harvard, philosopher Cornel West to the effect that Nietzsche was the single most important influence on postmodern thought, which is pretty funny, since only 50 years earlier, Nietzsche was widely reviled as the arch-reactionary, a sort of Nazi house philosopher. After the war, Stephenson said, Nietzsche had been pried loose from the Nazis' grip, cleaned up, and revived by translator, interpreter, and exegete Walter Kaufmann, among others, the distasteful parts of him ignored. A neat trick, but what would Nietzsche have made of it? And what would he have made of American academics turning his impassioned language into the received ideas of the Modern Language Association, the professional association of college language teachers and a bastion of left academic orthodoxy? Nietzsche, the celebrator of the Superman, as patron saint of the academic left. There was a joke buried here somewhere. Beginning his discussion of Nietzsche, Stephenson expressed his regret at presenting such an inflammatory work with so little contextual preparation. The book, like all the others, was slammed down on the table before us. And yet, eager as I was to stop and read everything Nietzsche had written, and then to go back and read Arthur Schopenhauer, his predecessor in German philosophy, I thought there was something to be said for this violent ripping of context, this naive reading of books. Too much preparation might cool out the experience, making it routine, merely academic, another brick in the arch rather than what it was, a grenade. In class, Charlie Kim, a Korean boy with a serious forehead and gentle manner, a student who wanted to be a missionary, was understandably wistful. Does Nietzsche's account hold true? Is the Judeo-Christian ethos like this? Stephenson asked, and Charlie answered, he misconstrues Christian ethics, but was unable to finish. There was more I knew, but he wasn't able to get it out yet. Nietzsche was a kick in the stomach. Is the Judeo-Christian tradition anti-life and all that? Asked Stephenson. He said it without his usual fierceness, softly almost. Nietzsche had insisted on the sickness of self-denial, the near criminality of it, as an attack on life. Sighs, shaking heads, a few smiles. There is a life-affirming aspect to Jewish religion and culture, said Abel Kern at last. But every religion has an ascetic side to it, too, meaning that he acquiesced in Nietzsche's mocking account of self-denial. Yes, said Charlie. But isn't the point of asceticism not to deny life, but to reach a higher form of life? It is life-affirming, isn't it? His question trailed off and hovered. Jesus said, follow me. That way of following Jesus becomes the basis of your whole life. He paused for a moment. Nietzsche misconstrues the purpose of suffering. What suffering affects, that's true life, not denial. You create a new life, a more powerful life. He spoke slowly as always, but strongly. Active belief was an affirmation of strength, not a consolation for the weak. Charlie had survived the great atheists Marx and Nietzsche. It was the third or fourth time in the year that a religious student, Walking without many companions, I'd seemed braver in the midst of the secular university than the many non-religious. If studied with any intensity at all, Nietzsche leaves one excited, angered, and badly bruised. Charlie may have survived, but despite my euphoria, I wasn't sure about myself. Giddiness can make you sick as well as excited. Nietzsche is a far more radical writer than Marx, who insisted that the coming socialist utopia would end class warfare and even end alienation. Nietzsche left one with a thrilled, frightening impression of a terrific rush to the edge of something. The abyss, he called it. The rush, frantic and laborious, took place over and over again. A peculiarly modern rhythm of restless despair, rage, and courage. God is dead, was Nietzsche's most famous assertion, even though the remark did not originate with him, by which he meant that God no longer lived at the center of Western consciousness, and that Christianity, after the Enlightenment, had lost its hold on the imagination. Immortality and the absolute law had vanished. Values were something created by men and women, not something inherent or something you could find. Not something out there. And this thought placed us in a situation of complete responsibility, possessed of an overwhelming opportunity to create ourselves or lose ourselves. In the last section of the genealogy, Nietzsche makes it clear that in giving up God, one is also giving up truth. Not empirical truth, something observable and measurable, such as the amount of pressure produced by steam in a closed container, but metaphysical truth, absolute truth, a set of universal norms. In a passage from the genealogy that is momentous for today's academic world, Nietzsche teases the notion, derived from Descartes perhaps, that a single mind working in a vacuum could arrive at truth. But precisely because we seek knowledge, let us not be ungrateful to such resolute reversals of accustomed perspectives and valuations with which the spirit has, with apparent mischievousness and futility, raged against itself for so long. To see differently in this way for once, to want to see differently, is no small discipline and preparation of the intellect for its future objectivity. The latter understood not as contemplation without interest, which is a nonsensical absurdity, but as the ability to control one's pro and con and to dispose of them, so that one knows how to employ a variety of perspectives and effective interpretations in the service of knowledge. Henceforth, my dear philosophers, let us be on guard against the dangerous old conceptual fiction that posited a pure, will-less, painless, timeless knowing subject. Let us guard against the snares of such contradictory concepts as pure reason, absolute spirituality, knowledge in itself. These always demand that we should think of an I that is completely unthinkable, an I turned in no particular direction, in which the active and interpreting forces, through which alone seeing becomes seeing something, are supposed to be lacking. These always demand of the I an absurdity and a nonsense. There is only a perspective seeing, only a perspective knowing. And the more affects we allow to speak about one thing, the more eyes, different eyes, we can use to observe one thing, the more complete will our concept of this thing, our objectivity, be. Knowing can only be achieved by the report of many eyes, a notion that the academic left has seized on with a passion. In the work of one of Nietzsche's modern disciples, the late Michel Foucault, whose influence over the American Academy in the last 20 years has been extraordinary. Truth hardly functions independently at all. Truth or knowing without some implication for the exercise of power is scarcely imaginable. Certain systems of knowledge, say psychology and all that it had to say about criminality or sexual behavior, allow one to dispose of bodies by sending them to prison or by designating them as schizophrenic or homosexual or whatever. Such discursive practices have functioned as forms of power, and truth, as used within them, has served a controlling, even dominating function. So truth is hardly innocent or neutral. In making values and judgments through the means of its particular language, the discourse reinforces itself and renders what lies outside the discourse's focus anomalies that cannot be easily reconciled with truth as it functions within the discourse marginal or non-existent. Behavior gets coerced or ignored by truth. Foucault's American Imitators, pushing his ideas in a more explicit political direction than Foucault himself, would speak as if the discourse itself constitutes the truths that it is supposed to be discovering. A malign paradox. Thus a Foucauldian might say that if one is talking about sex and character, sex may be fixed, but gender, in the sense of male or female temperament and roles, was something socially constructed by the existing language of sex, as well as by economics and class and so on. There was nothing inherent, natural, or essential in gender. Its alleged characteristics were all constructed. In his insistence that truth was a matter of perspective, Nietzsche had unleashed a whirlwind. And now, in the midst of these thoughts, my mind wandered back to a conference I had attended in October, early in the first semester. A small group of scholars, all from other universities, had gathered at Columbia in a large lecture room in Skimmerhorn Hall, the Natural Sciences Building. In the university world, this was one of many such meetings. Throughout the late 80s and early 90s, big trouble was brewing. The English, comparative literature, and history departments had been under siege. A fusillade of books, articles, news magazine cover stories, and statements by public figures had attacked or at least questioned the new left academic approach to the Western classics and Western history. The criticism had come not just from the right, but from the left and center, and now communities within the university were hitting back. Suddenly aroused to their vulnerability, the professors complained of misrepresentation, alarmism, and hidden political agendas. As conferences go, the Columbia gathering was small potatoes. Nothing like the huge annual meeting of the Modern Language Association or the many scholarly gatherings on one aspect or another of literature and gender or literature and race. The conference was no more than a handful of people pulled together by ambitious graduate students. I will not detail the standard attacks on the Western canon. By this time, you can imagine them on your own. What fascinated me, however, was the coldly disgusted tone of the remarks. I sat there silently, taking notes, thinking to myself, they do not love literature. They do not love it. I had one moment of sympathy, however, one moment when I felt ashamed of my hostility. A number of the professors who spoke taught at large public universities, and many of their minority students were dropping out. Their dilemma as teachers was excruciating and possibly insoluble. But my moment of sympathy evaporated. Rather than identify their problems openly, the speakers attacked the curriculum and the structure of the university. If the students were bored and dropping out, then there was something wrong with the courses or the books. They turned an extraordinarily complex and deep-rooted series of social problems, the inequality of American society, the problems of poverty and race, into an attack on the Western canon. The graduate student spoke as well, unmemorably, in pasteboard phrases drawn from the current gods, Foucault, Jacques Lacan, and Duke University English professor Stanley Fish. The student's statements were radical in content, but obsequious in tone. As persons, these students were as timid as mice. They sidled up apprehensively to any established professor in sight, nodding their heads in agreement. Revolutionaries? Radicals? This was a job hunt. The graduate students embracing theory were university careerists and inside players, adapting themselves to the dominant culture of the humanities, which at the moment is largely feminist, neo-Marxist, multicultural, new historicist, anti-canonical, and so on. The pressures of the job hunt had enforced a desperate conformity. I felt for them, but I did not admire them. Camille Paglia, the academic anti-academic, had described them scornfully and well in her many Jeremiads. The graduate students were denizens of the university world, and a good part of their radical critique of the curriculum I now saw was produced by nothing more earth-shattering than the evident desire to claim turf, get themselves noticed, and find a job somewhere. So why get upset? They were effective only within the university. I was upset because they did not love literature, and because they would teach our children, my children, English, history, philosophy, sociology, anthropology, and science. My sons would take courses from these dry-souled clerics. And there was something else, their tone. The cultural left on campus may be authorized by Nietzsche only distantly. He may be their patron saint and unholy god only through many degrees of separation, mediation, and change. Friedrich Nietzsche was not a multiculturalist. But he has had his influence, as Cornel West said. The notion that truth is a matter of perspective radiates in many directions, all of them subversive. Yet here's the kicker. The silliest of the academic left were precisely the kind of people Nietzsche had in mind when he described with such venomous anger the temperament of ascetic personalities. They walk among us as embodied reproaches, as warnings to us. They exploit a resentment in the name of justice and turn their anger against the strong. The school of resentment, critic Harold Bloom called them, thinking explicitly of Nietzsche and lumping all the theoretical and cultural studies approaches into one. And who, you ask, are the strong whom the most dreary and conformist left academics resent? After going to that little conference at Columbia, it became clear to me that the strong were not just powerful white men, but literature itself. The academic left had created a moralized fable of power and victimization. People were being hurt by taking courses that didn't represent them directly. Blacks and women were being weakened by reading Homer, Plato, Shakespeare, Hegel, and Freud without also reading, at the same time, female and black authors. Did the case have merit? Were people truly hurt? It was a good question, one worth looking into. But meritorious or not, these notions had successfully infected the universities with guilt and shame. So the Nietzschean comedy of ethics was complete. Some of Nietzsche's heirs had become what he despised. This was the joke I was looking for. You can preserve a Nietzschean perspective, said Anders Stephenson, and still talk about good and bad. Give up once and for all the notion that if you're not an absolutist, you're a relativist, or vice versa. You can historicize all you want and still take the position that something is good or pernicious. Just because you can't do it in a theoretical sense, in an absolute sense, you can still posit a universal norm. He stopped for a second to be sure we were getting it, and then he said with great emphasis, if a norm exists just between individuals, society isn't possible. You can posit universal norms. Say a country should not be invaded and annihilated. Sure, you have to account in each case for the historical circumstances. But the idea that you can't judge is an egregious error. The Nazis created genocide as a norm. Are we saying we can't judge? He had said it before, but never this forcefully, and I felt immensely relieved. I had halfway restored myself politically. I would not take false claims of victimization seriously, but real claims were as pressing as ever. And now I understood that Nietzsche could not be used properly to license a shallow relativism. Like Nietzsche, like members of the academic left, I did not believe in metaphysical truth. I was not, in the jargon, a foundationalist. That is, I did not believe that values existed outside of human practice. On the contrary, values would exist in whatever form we give them. But still, you could judge, in life and by extension, in literature. You did not need some foundational notion, a transcendent or universal notion of literary value, in order to say that Jane Austen was a great writer worthy of study and emulation, and Alice Walker was not. Instead, you had to make the case for pleasure from the ground up. The case for the most complex pleasures had to be made freshly for each generation. By denying that case, by ruling it out as some sort of reactionary formation, members of the academic left were cutting the ground from beneath their feet, destroying the means by which we have universities and reading lists at all. By their very nature, reading lists exclude almost everything previously written. Any other way of composing them would lead to sheer chaos. The cannon-bashing academic left had inappropriately carried the democratic ideal of representation into the realm of culture. They had given up history, given up their own judgment, and had allowed, of all things, market principles satisfy the customer's needs into the curriculum. They began in a high-minded way, respecting everyone's culture as equal, and they were in danger of truly valuing nothing. A group of us stood around, pawing the ground and glancing at each other nervously. We were waiting for the women. A strange, nasty sound, high-pitched, insistent, floated over Broadway. The women, Columbia and Barnard students, now emerged from the Columbia gates at 116th Street and walked across Broadway and then north toward Barnard. The sound became clearer. Some of the women were shrieking and rapidly flapping their tongues, an evocation of Africa or perhaps Afghanistan as the Mujahideen left their villages to fight the Soviet tanks, and many others were blowing whistles. Shrieks and whistles. The combination was unnerving. The anti-human quality of it, I thought, could only be intentional. Women could be as alien, hostile, and cold as crunched electrons encountering themselves in rebarbative fury. Feedback. Women could be as inhuman as men. That was the real meaning, wasn't it? Men were meant to be intimidated by a concentrated version of their own unpleasantness. The marchers swept through the Barnard gates, turned right at Barnard Hall, and settled on the damp lawn in front of Lehman Hall. Men joined girlfriends or just friends and settled on the lawn. It was late March, and Take Back the Night, a yearly event, was being held at many American campuses. The first part of the evening, the march around Columbia, men were forbidden to join, had been completed. Now, around 11 o'clock, the second part got underway. An open microphone stood on the stone terrace outside Lehman, and women lined up to speak. Don't go to the fraternity. I was wrestled to the ground. I was overpowered and helpless. There was nothing I could do. I can't believe that I went there three times. My parents raped me. My parents raped me over and over. I was raped by boys and men all through school. It's taken me 5 years to say this. I was a junior in high school and I was happy. I was a virgin and I was happy. I met this boy from Georgetown and he was cute. Not all Georgetown boys are nice. His name is John. If this guy runs for congressman, don't support him. He was cute, and I went to a party with him, and he gave me vodka to drink. Only afterwards did I realize that he was pouring this much for me and this much for himself. I passed out. But the last thing I remember is saying no. I knew he used a condom because I found it on the back of my leg. I crawled to the bathroom and threw up. The rain had stopped and I sat on my raincoat in the back near the outer edges of the crowd, perhaps 500 or 600 students, and took notes, writing down as many stories as possible. I'd gone out of curiosity with no thought in mind except to see what the event was about. But as I listened, and even more so in the weeks afterward, the stories and the core curriculum works we had been reading all year kept calling to one another in some indistinct yet clamorous way that I couldn't ignore. In our society, sexual life is one of the worldly garments of the soul. Certainly the women's stories said much about abuse, but also about souls, about the way pain should be dealt with and life confronted. How would you make a self, a public self? Here are women grief-struck and enraged, women marked by experience.